me because my wife loves the story of Les Mis. Some of you know this, but Les Mis was actually written in the form of a book first. And Chantel's been trying to get me to read this book for a long time, but have you ever seen how big this book is? And I just told her I don't have 3 or 4 years to spare, you know, to read that story. So when the movie was coming out, I knew that I was going to end up going to the theater to watch this movie and hear the story that she so loves. And so I went online to buy tickets to the theater like a lot of you have done. And when you go online, you can actually see how long the movie is going to last, right? So I was buying my tickets online. I didn't know what Les Miserables really stood for. I decided online when buying my tickets that it must be French for, you know, the next 2.5 hours of your life is going to be really miserable, you know? That's kind of what I ascertained that Les Miserables really stood for. And then I began to read a little bit more about the movie. I kind of wanted to have an idea going in what it was about. And I came across a review by a guy named Sam Richardson that I thought was so tremendously helpful. So I thought I would share this review since so many of you really haven't seen the movie. Here's kind of how Sam described his experience. I went to the movies with my wife. We saw this obscure movie I have never heard of, some French foreign film. They must have been giving away free tickets because the lines were out the door. Anyway, the movie starts and Wolverine is singing his guts out, which is true. Then Catwoman starts crying and singing, and it's all very, very moving, okay? The only problem was the girl next to me, who had apparently read the book or something, starts singing along. It was all very distracting. So Wolverine is on the run from the gladiator because Catwoman had a baby at Borat's house. But now she wants Wolverine to care for her, okay? Time skip, a bunch of kids get shot, and in the end, everyone dies. 4 stars. So I thought, I saw the movie. That's a perfect description of what happened in the movie. Now, there's a few gaps that he didn't really explain. The movie is actually incredible, you know? Like any great episode of Seinfeld, right? There are multiple stories running parallel in the overall narrative of Les Mis. One of those stories is of Anne Hathaway's character, Fantine, and she really is an integral part of the story, but she's a part of an overall story. And the overall story is really about the main character, Wolverine, okay? His name is Jean Valjean. And the story does open up with him serving time in a prison work crew, and he is singing his guts out. I didn't even know the guy could sing, okay? But he's singing his guts out. He's a part of this prison work crew, and he's been in prison for 19 years because he stole some bread to feed his starving family, which is a real ethical dilemma that we should talk about one day. And so he's serving in prison. This 19-year sentence is up, and he's being released from prison. And so as he leaves prison, he actually sings his way out, which is super awesome, I guess. So he sings his way out of prison. He's singing along the way the whole time. All they do is sing, right? And he leaves prison. He's hungry. He's angry. He's bitter. He's frustrated. He's homeless. And he finds himself wandering the streets after 19 years of being in prison. And he stumbles upon a church. And the bishop of the church takes Jean Valjean in. And he gives him a place to stay, gives him shelter for the night. He cleans him up, gives him something new to wear. They feed him, and in the movie you see him just eating. He's famished. He's eating like he's never seen food before. And so during the night, everybody goes to bed, and Jean Valjean decides that the best use of his time is to pack a sack that he found full of all the silver and all of the goods and the wares that he can find in this church. He packs him up, and in the middle of the night, he flees, stealing all of this wealth from the church. Well, the next morning, he's caught with this bag full of silver, and the police inspector, Gladiator, and all of his police friends know that Wolverine doesn't own all of this stuff. So they take Jean Valjean back to the church where it belongs, and they sit him before the priest, and he actually kneels down on his knees. And John has been claiming the whole time that the pastor gave him all of this good, that the bishop has given him all this silver, but the police know better. They know that he stole it. So as he's kneeling there before the bishop and before the church, the police have him in handcuffs, he knows what's about to happen. He knows that he's going back to prison. He hated being there, and he knows that's where he's going, and probably not for 19 years. He knows he's going back for life as a repeat offender in France. And so there's really nothing good that's going to come from this moment. And he begins to plead his case, but the bishop stops him. And he says, Jean, I'm so glad that you came back. I'm so glad you're here. Because last night in your haste to leave, you forgot the most valuable thing that I wanted to give you. And he grabs these two large silver candlesticks that are sitting on the dining room table, and he puts them in Jean Valjean's bag. And he says, John, this is the best thing that I gave you, and you left so quickly, you forgot to take them. Well, the police know the bishop is lying. And the police know that Jean Valjean has robbed the church, and now he's getting away with it. And in the movie, when you see John's face, you can see just this utter look of confusion and bewilderment. He doesn't even know what to do with this gift that he's been giving. So the police kind of let him go, and he stands up, and he grabs the bag of silver, now complete with two brand new expensive candlesticks. And he begins to walk out. And as he walks out, the bishop stops him, and he says, John, you have been given a great gift. I want you to do something good with what you've been given. So Jean leaves. Well, he's still kind of a criminal, and he's still a little bit frustrated. So he commits another little petty crime, but he immediately recognizes what he's done. And he tries to make up for it, but he really can't. But the police find out that he did it, and they are on to him because they want this guy back in prison. They're already so mad that he got away with robbing the church. And then for the bishop of all things to let him get away with it and give him more, they couldn't understand it. They were so mad about it, but now they can get him. So Jean is on the run from the inspector. And the rest of the movie plays out where the inspector is searching for Jean Valjean, but he takes the bishop's word to heart and he moves to another city. He changes his name. He actually becomes the mayor of this new town. He becomes a very, very wealthy factory owner. He employs dozens and dozens and dozens of females, of women, of moms in this community who were all destitute, who were all unbelievably poor, who were very much miserable, and gives them a way to earn a living and provides for them. Well, over time, what we see is Jean Valjean shows amazing, amazing grace to everyone he comes in contact with. Because the experience that he had in the church did something in his heart and it changed him. It made him a different person. And so he bumps into Anne Hathaway's character and he takes care of her, shows amazing grace to her as he helps her through this season of loss and tragedy. And she dies and he pays for all the medical bills as they try to save her life. She has a daughter who she's never really been with. So he finds out about this daughter. He goes and adopts this daughter who's in a terrible situation living in Borat's house. You can imagine how great that would be, right? He goes and adopts this daughter and takes unbelievable care of her, showing so much grace. This daughter grows up, becomes a beautiful young lady, singing her way the whole time, and falls in love with a guy. Jean shows unbelievable grace and saves this man's life by dragging him through the sewers. Unbelievable grace he shows this guy because of his love for his daughter. And then he even shows grace to the police inspector, who continually is pursuing him in spite of the grace that he's been shown. And even though he knows he got away with something, the police can't let it go, and John shows unbelievable grace to the police inspector. In fact, he shows so much grace to the police inspector, it confuses him to a point that he ends up committing suicide because he can't handle it. He can't understand or can't comprehend the grace that he's been given. And so skip forward, you know, a whole bunch of kids get shot, probably because they wouldn't stop singing, I don't know, okay? But a bunch of kids get shot, right? This revolution that's happening. And at the end of the movie, Jean Valjean is sitting in the very church where the story kind of begins. The candlesticks right behind him. He's basically in hospice care. He's dying. His stepdaughter, who now is married to this husband, finds out that he's at death's door. He didn't want him to know. So they rush to the church. They rush in, and they find him kind of slumped over in this wheelchair. And they run in and they embrace. It's a beautiful moment. They all cry. Everybody in the audience cries, if you have a heart, including me for a moment or two, maybe, okay? And Jean Valjean dies in the arms of people who love him and in the arms of people who he has shown amazing, amazing grace towards. It's a very, very moving story. It's a beautiful story. It's a story that's built on one word, and that word is grace. The entire story of Les Mis is one narrative that's wrapped around the idea of grace. Now, when I came out of the theater, and dried my eyes, sad to say, when I came out of the theater, I had a couple of observations about the movie. The first observation was that Les Mis does not mean that this is going to be miserable, okay? Les Miserables, I think, is French for whatever you do, don't stop singing, okay? Because that's what they did. So I have to assume that's what it meant. But here's the real observation. When I walked out of the theater, here's what I realized about grace. Everyone is confused by grace. Everyone is confused by grace. Jean Valjean, as he kneels in front of the bishop, and the bishop gives him candlesticks, he doesn't even know what to do. He is so confused by grace. But while everyone is confused by grace, everyone is drawn to grace. Everyone is confused by grace, yet every single one in the world, you, me included, are drawn to grace. It's an interesting thing. And this is what I want us to lean into today. And this is what I want us to talk about today. Because just like last week, we said that we're going to talk for a few weeks about one single verse that Paul wrote to the brand new Christians in these brand new churches in the city of Colossae. And as Paul is sitting in prison in Rome, he writes this letter to encourage these Christians. And he tells them at the end of the letter that they need to be very, very wise in the way that they act towards outsiders, which are people who are not Christians. Paul says that, hey, you guys in Colossae, you who are Christians, and I think he would say this to us, you need to be really, really wise in the way you act towards outsiders, and you need to make the most of every opportunity. And then in chapter 4 of Colossians, verse 6, he tells us how we should be wise and how we as Christians should make the most of all of these opportunities that we have with people in the world who maybe don't believe what we believe. And we introduced this verse last week, and here's how Paul said that we should do it as Christians. He said that our conversations should be always full of grace, seasoned with salt. Let our conversations be always full of grace, seasoned with salt. And so last week we kind of backed up and said, let's talk about this word conversation. This word conversation is so important when it comes to this idea. And here's what we said, that conversation is really the key to connection, whether it's with our spouses in a dating relationship, with our children, with our friends, our coworkers, or with people who are far from God. Conversations really is the key to connection. And we said that for us as Christians, we like to lean a little less into conversation. We like to lean more into confrontations. And confrontations are really ice makers. Conversations build blocks of ice around the hearts of the people who we really probably care about a lot and the people who we really want to reach. And so what we said is that while a confrontation may build some ice, it's conversations that begin to break this ice away. And it's the process of conversation that begins to get to the heart of the person that we're trying to reach. In fact, we said last week that if our goal is to get to someone's heart, a conversation is where we have to start. And conversations are a little bit like journeys. They can be difficult at times. They can be a little messy. You can have shards of ice hitting you in the face. There's all sorts of problems with conversations, right? Conversations are like journeys in the fact that they often have a beginning, but they don't always have an ending. Conversations have a lot of agreements. They also have a lot of disagreements. When we have conversations, we understand that it's a process, but we also know that if we hope to get to someone's heart, a conversation is where it all has to start. Now, with that in mind, we said last week, what should these conversations look like? If we're going to lean into conversations as Christians, if we're going to steer clear from confrontation, what should these conversations really look like? And Paul answers that question in this verse. He says that our conversations should be always full of grace and seasoned with salt. Full of grace and seasoned with salt. Now, you would think as Christians, we would be able to read this verse and just go home and apply it. Because this doesn't sound that complicated. I mean, having a conversation is a really hard thing. But a conversation that's full of grace and seasoned with salt, that seems like it would be easy enough, but not so fast, right? Because I think there's one of these things we do pretty well as Christians. I think there's one of these things that we understand a little more. But there's one that we really struggle with. There's one that we don't really understand, and I think it may be the most important one. So here's what we need to do. Let's start with the one that we understand the most. Let's start with salt, seasoned with salt. In the first century when Paul wrote this letter, salt was a really important thing in their culture. In fact, it was so important, sometimes salt was actually used as currency, not money. And so salt had a lot of meaning and had a lot of value in the first century. It was used in the same way that we use it. They used it to season food and to make food taste a little better. But they also use it as a preservative because salt, when packed around food products, keeps them from corrupting. So in our context, when Paul says that our conversations should be seasoned with salt, what he is suggesting is that our conversation should have an element of truth, an element of insight, because just like salt, truth preserves, doesn't it? Truth helps prevent corruption, and truth makes things a little bit better. Truth makes our life a little bit better, which is why we as Christians want to lead with that. Because as Christians, we look around the world and we think, hey, this world needs a lot of truth. And I know some truth. And the truth that I know has been so helpful for me in my life. And I think the world needs to know about that truth. So we take to Facebook and we use our status to be salt shakers, you know? And we use our political system to be salt shakers. And Paul says, no, I don't think that's what we should be doing. As Christians, to be really wise in the way we act towards outsiders, we just need to season with salt. So let me ask you, in our context, if you're like me, you probably like to eat soup. You've all had some soup that need a little salt before. In fact, almost habitually, when I get a bowl of soup, I just sprinkle in some salt, even before I taste it, because I know it needs a little bit to make it taste better. And salt sprinkled on soup always makes my soup taste better. But have you ever decided to eat a bowl of salt? It's disgusting, okay? Like, salt by itself isn't really that helpful, but salt used as a seasoning, wow, really, really helpful. You know, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. A spoonful of salt just lands you in the doctor's office and getting blood pressure medication, you know? I mean, salt is really, really helpful. Salt preserves. Salt adds a lot of value. But salt by itself, it's kind of gross. And that's what Paul is suggesting. Paul is saying that instead of leading with truth and leading with salt, we should season with salt. We should season with truth. Now, before anybody gets upset and emails me, I am not suggesting, and neither is Paul suggesting, that as Christians we should steer away from truth. That is not the point. Paul is not saying that as Christians we should never have difficult conversations. He's not suggesting that we water down the truth. He's not suggesting even that we completely avoid confrontation. That's not what he's saying. In fact, this is Paul writing this. Paul, who was in prison for the truth. When he wrote this, he was in prison, and eventually he was going to be executed for the truth. He was executed because of salt. So he's not suggesting that we avoid salt, but he is suggesting that we only sprinkle with salt if we're hoping to reach a person's heart and eventually maybe even change their life. So if we're not going to lead with salt, what are we supposed to lead with? And again, Paul tells us that we as Christians should have conversations that are full of grace, that are full of grace. Now, grace is a little bit hard to understand, as we kind of talked about with Jean Valjean in Les Mis. Grace doesn't always make a lot of sense. Here's what grace really is. If we were to define grace, we would say that it's freely given, unmerited favor. Grace is a freely given and unmerited favor. Grace is really an oxymoron. It's like jumbo shrimp. I mean, it's an undeserved gift. It's something you get, a favor that you didn't earn, that you didn't deserve, which is partially why it's so confusing. That just doesn't make sense. When I used to work with middle school students, which was a riot in and of itself, I would always bring a couple of students on stage to illustrate what grace really was, because it's so hard to understand. So I would bring two students on stage, and I would have them stand beside me, which, you know, the sixth grade boys come on stage. They always thought that was great, and we would protect the stage from the sixth grade boys. And so we would bring them up there, and I would say, let me illustrate what this looks like. And I would tell the first kid, I would say, hey, I want you to punch me in the arm, right? And so a sixth grade boy thinks, oh, that's awesome. I'm going to punch this guy. So he would punch me in the arm. And then I would turn around and I would just deck him back. I would punch him in the arm really hard, you know. One, because I wanted him to know who was boss. You know, I'm in charge. And it's a good reminder. I could destroy you at any moment. So, you know, be careful around me, right? But I would punch him in the arm and everybody would start laughing except for him. And I would stand by him. And I would say, this is fair, right? He punched me, I punched him back. That's fair. That's what should happen. So then I'm going to go to the next person, and I would say, hey, I want you to punch me in the arm. And he would go, no. Right? And everybody's going, punch him. And he's like, no, I'm not doing that. And I would say, you can trust me, punch me. And he would go, I don't trust you at all. I just saw what you did, you know? And I go, trust me, pretend I'm Jesus. And he goes, you're nothing like Jesus. And I go, I know. Punch me in the arm. So eventually he would punch me, but he would just tap me because he was scared. He would tap me and start to run away, and I would grab him, and he would kind of cower, and I would pretend to hit him, and I would stop, and I go, no, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to hit you back. And out of my pocket, I would pull a giant oversized candy bar, and I would hand it to him. Of course, everybody thought that was awesome, except the kid who got punched. He didn't like that so much, right? And I would say, that's grace. You see, fairness is getting what you deserve. You punch me, I punch you back. That's fair. Grace is getting exactly what you don't deserve. Grace is getting a candy bar instead of a punch. Grace is unmerited favor. It's undeserved, freely given favor, which is why grace is so confusing. I mean, have you ever seen this displayed in our world? I mean, when you walk around your offices at work, when you walk around your homes, your neighborhoods, have you ever bumped into a police officer? I mean, freely given unmerited favor, not always the way our world works, okay? Have you ever heard of the story where a salesman, you know, a salesman has a quota that he has to sell every quarter. Have you ever heard the story where the salesman for 3 quarters in a row failed to meet his quota? So his boss calls him in for an 8 a.m. meeting. And he walks into the boss's office, and the boss says, sit down, we need to have a conversation. You know what the conversation's about. And he says, here's the deal. You haven't met your quota for 3 straight quarters. And I think that's awesome. We're going to promote you to vice president of sales and give you a raise. See, we don't have that, do we? That doesn't happen, because that wouldn't be fair. I mean, have you ever heard of Harvard sending in a letter to a high school student that says, in spite of your 2.1 GPA, and your 600 combined SAT score, you know, we would like to offer you an academic scholarship to Harvard, right? That doesn't happen, you know? I mean, have you ever seen a person break up with Taylor Swift and not have a song written about him, you know? It doesn't happen, right? You break up with me, I'm writing a song about you. That's fair, you know? That's the world that we live in. But can you imagine? Can you imagine if our world wasn't like that? I mean, make it real small. Can you imagine if your home wasn't like that? Like, what would your marriage look like? If you're married, what would your marriage look like if you led from a place of grace? Wouldn't that be unbelievable? Like, what if instead of loving your spouse when they're lovable only, you just decided to love them? They would be so confused by that, right? But they would be so drawn to it. Like, what if instead of, you know, as a husband, doing the dishes today so you can play golf tomorrow, right? That explains the first 6 years of my marriage, by the way, right? What if instead of doing the dishes today so you can play golf tomorrow, what if you just did the dishes with no expectation of anything else? See, some of your wives would fall on the floor to be so confused by that. But they would be so drawn to you, because grace is confusing, but it draws us in. See, some of you grew up in a church like I did, where grace really wasn't the primary thing that we experienced. At my church as a kid, we said grace a lot, but we didn't show grace a lot, you know? We weren't really a grace factory. We were more of a salt mine, you know? We were really concerned with salt. We were really concerned with truth. We were really concerned with rules and do's and don'ts. I grew up thinking that God really cared more about my behavior than anything else, because if I did the right thing, God would be happy. If I did the wrong thing, lightning is coming at some point, so do the right thing. And I thought that's what Christianity was about. I thought that's what God was about. It was all about the rules and the regulations, you know? And I should have known something was up, you know, when I was a kid, and they would tell us the story of Jesus turning water into sweet tea, you know, at the wedding. I was like, I don't think that's what he did. You know, like, I know, it was grape juice. I'm like, no, I don't think it was, you know. In fact, you know why my Baptist church as a kid was so against drinking? It's because they were afraid it was going to lead to dancing, right? And they couldn't have that, you know, nervous laughter from all the former Baptists, right? So here's the deal, right? That was my church. And that's how I saw God, because the church functions so much like the world. And we as Christians often function so much like the world. And the world is a world of fairness. It's not a world of grace. That's why we have speed limits, not speed suggestions, right? Because our world is a world of fairness. Now, here's the weird thing. If grace is so confusing, and if grace doesn't exist anywhere really in our world for the most part, why would Paul suggest that when we are interacting with outsiders, the best way for us to be wise and to make the most of every opportunity is to lead with grace? Why would he suggest that our conversations should be full of grace? Here's why I think. Because as confusing as grace may be, there is nothing more attractive than grace. There is nothing in our world that draws us together like grace. There is nothing that wins a person's heart like grace. And what Paul knew is that if we as Christians were going to influence the world and influence the people around us, to influence somebody, we had to get to their heart first. And the way to get to a person's heart is not through salt. It's through grace. But grace is the mechanism that opens the door for us to sprinkle a little bit of salt. You see, Jesus, no shock, was the master at understanding the importance of grace. In fact, in the conversations that we watch that Jesus had in any of the accounts of his life in the New Testament, they were always full of grace. But there was a lot of times where he did some sprinkling of salt as well. Because what Jesus wanted for the people he interacted with is the same thing I think that he wants for you. And honestly, I think it's the same thing that we want for people we interact with. We want them to know the truth. We want them to know about Jesus. We want them to know that he is the only answer to every problem in the world. And we know that he's the answer. And we want everybody to know that, which is why we want to lead with salt. But Paul says, and Jesus displays, no, let's not lead with salt. Let's lead with grace. Let's lead with love. Let's lead with acceptance. And let's allow that to be what opens the door to sprinkle in a little bit of salt. So here's what I thought we would do. I want to show you an illustration, an interaction that Jesus had with a woman in the Bible that just so epitomizes this idea. And a lot of you have heard this story before. And if you have, I want to ask you not to skip to the end and act like you've been there before, because there is a moment in this story that is so powerful. And it's a moment that I think every single person in the room has felt before. And I will promise you it's an emotion, it's a feeling that every single person who's not a Christian has felt before when they stood in front of a Christian. So this is in John chapter 8. If you have your Bible, you can follow along, or we're going to put it up here. Here's kind of how it starts. John chapter 8, beginning in verse 3. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. So the setting for this is Jesus is in the temple courts. He's teaching about this new kingdom that is to come. He's teaching about what God is doing in the world. And while he is in the temple courts, the Pharisees have caught a woman in the act of adultery. Now, whenever you read the word Pharisee in the Bible, you should have like a mental soundtrack that goes off that sounds kind of like this. Dun, 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 right? Because the Pharisees were always up to trouble. Now, what's funny about the Pharisees, though, is that while they always seem to be causing trouble for Jesus, they were the Christians of the day. They were the religious leaders, the religious elite of the first century for Judaism. As a Pharisee, your number one job was to keep the law and to make sure you yelled at everybody who didn't keep the law. That's what you did as a Pharisee. Make sure everybody follows the rules and make sure that you follow the rules. I mean, their whole life revolved around salt, okay? We could probably call these guys the Pharisaults because that's what they did, all right? Everything in their life was about salt. I mean, when they took vacations, they went to the Dead Sea, okay? Some of you Bible scholars get that, right? Full of salt, right? Blood pressure through the roof. All they cared was about truth. That's all they cared about. And they wanted to trap Jesus. And eventually, they wanted to crucify him by catching him, maybe breaking the law. So here is what happens next. This is unbelievable. The Pharisees bring this woman before him. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery." Next verse. In the law, Jesus, do you know what the law says? To which the Bible doesn't say. I think Jesus said, "Yeah, I know exactly what the law says. I wrote it." You know, I'm the one who talked to Moses in the burning bush. Were you there? I was. I know what the law says. I know what the law says. So the Pharisees say to Jesus, "In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say, Jesus?" Jesus, you know what the law says. If a woman is caught in the act of adultery, or if a woman has committed adultery, she is to be stoned to death immediately. There is no grace in this. You know exactly what the law says. What do you think we should do, Jesus? Now, let me ask, can you put yourself in this woman's shoes for a minute? Can you imagine what that must have felt like? I mean, not only to be caught in a wrong that you know is wrong, but not only that, to be drug out to stand before a group of people who are all holding stones ready to kill you for your wrong. Can you imagine what that felt like to be her? See, I think some of us can't imagine. Because some of us have been in a very similar scenario, haven't we? We've been in a circumstance where we were caught in the middle of a lie or deception, or maybe even like her, in the middle of an affair. And it was devastating. And the person that you stood before was the person who you hurt the most. And they held the right to condemn you. They held the right to throw that proverbial stone at you. And maybe it was, you know, as simple as you had detention in school, and you're in the principal's office. Or maybe it's your spouse says, "Well, I'm out of here. This is over." Or maybe it's your kid who says, "That's it. I've had enough. I'm leaving. I'm probably never coming back." See, I think that we can almost embrace where this woman is at and what she's feeling. never getting to say goodbye to her loved ones, never seeing the people who cared about her and who she cared about. Her sentence is about to be executed right then and right there. So the Bible says that Jesus doesn't really answer the question. Here's what he does. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. So this whole group of people standing around with rocks, there's a woman who's been caught in the act of something terrible. And Jesus doesn't even answer the question. He bends down and starts writing in the ground. Now, we don't know what he wrote. Biblical scholars have made up all sorts of things they think he wrote. I mean, he may have just been writing good grief. I don't know what he was writing, you know? Or maybe he was writing grace. Or maybe he was writing fair assaults. I don't know, right? I don't know what he was writing. But here's what happens next. When they kept on questioning him, the Pharisees, when they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, check this out, let any one of you who is without sin, let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her. You see, in this culture, very much like ours, we like to grade sin. We like to think that other people's sins are worse than ours. Somehow that's always how the grading works. I don't know how that's the case, right? But we like to think that some sins are worse than others. And Jesus says, hey, any of you who haven't sinned, you can start throwing some rocks. But when it comes to my kingdom, when it comes to God, sin is sin. There aren't grades of sin. It's all the same. It all separates you from me, and it all makes your life bad, which is why I've given you rules and why I've given you some commandments, because I just don't want your life to be bad. I want you to have the greatest life possible, and sin takes us away from that greatest life possible. So as Jesus stands here with these guys, he says, any of you who haven't done anything wrong, go ahead and start throwing some rocks. And John tells us that one by one, beginning from the oldest to the youngest, they began to drop their rocks and walk away. I imagine the young guys were, you know, warming up their rotator cuffs, you know, looking around like, where are all the old guys, you know? But the old guys had more wisdom, and they realized that they weren't any better, that they had broke their, they had broke God's commands before. In fact, they realized, probably like us, that we haven't even lived up to our own standards. Who are we to throw rocks? We don't even do what we say that we should do. Why should we throw rocks at anybody else? And so as the people walk away, Jesus is left standing there. And he's left there with this one woman. And here's what happens. Jesus straightened up and he asked her, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? Has no one condemned you? And she answers back, no one, sir, she said. And look at what Jesus says back to her. This is unbelievable. Then neither do I condemn you, Jesus declared, full of grace. Does she deserve to be condemned? Absolutely. What did the law teach? She should have been stoned. That's the salt. That's the truth. But what did Jesus do? He leaned in to grace because Jesus cared more about her heart than he did her behavior. Jesus cared more about changing her heart than he did about changing her behavior because Jesus knew that if he changes her heart, her behavior will change automatically. So he leans into grace, and then look what he says next, though. Seasoned with salt. Go now and leave your life of sin. Full of grace, seasoned with salt. So let me ask you this. When you think about this story, and this may be very difficult for you to hear. Maybe this is where some of you are actually at. It's hard to hear that, right? But when Jesus interacts with her, it's the same way he interacts with us. He interacts from a place of grace because Jesus understood that if he is going to get to our heart, it has to be from a place of grace first. But grace is going to open up the door to season with a little bit of salt. Now, I grew up hearing this story over and over and over again. It was a little awkward in preschool, mind you, okay? But I'm just kidding, I didn't do it in preschool. But I grew up hearing this story all the time. And every time I heard this story, I walked away feeling the same thing. I felt, I'm so glad that Jesus didn't condemn this woman. Because if he didn't condemn her, that makes me feel like maybe he won't condemn me either. If he didn't condemn her, maybe that means that he'll love me still, even though my behavior's bad. It's not this bad, I would think. I'm not perfect, but I'm better than this, is what I would think. But maybe he won't condemn me either. But you know what I never noticed? Is that as happy as I was that Jesus maybe wasn't going to condemn me, I never realized how everybody around was feeling condemned by me. Because as a Christian, I was full of salt. I was full of truth. And I had been forgiven, and you hadn't, and I was going to tell you about it. And I was full of that. It's full of truth, full of insight. And it just wasn't helpful. And then several years ago, I came across this verse. And it hit me What does it look like to be full of grace, not full of salt? What does it look like as a Christian to be full of acceptance and love, not full of truth and insight when it comes to outsiders? And so here's what I figured out, that when we lean into grace, people are drawn to us. When we lead with grace, it opens up the door to people's hearts. You know, in a weird way, grace is so hard to understand because we don't experience it in our world. And that's part of the problem. Now, when you face something that's hard to understand, what is the best way for you to get a hold of it? I would argue it's by experience. Experience is always the best teacher, isn't it? Well, guess what? When it comes to grace, experience is the best teacher. And if we're hoping for outsiders to understand what God's grace looks like, probably the only way they're going to understand it is if they experience it through you and through me as Christians first. Here's what I have figured out, that people experience God's grace through my grace. As a Christian, people experience God's grace through my grace. And experience is the best teacher. And experiencing my grace begins to help them understand a little bit more about God's grace. And it opens up a little bit more of a door as well for truth. So here's what we said, that while confrontations and even condemnation may be an incredible icebreaker, and it may do a lot of good, and as we lean into these conversations, we really begin to get to the heart of people, the reality is that grace is the ultimate icebreaker. Because when we lead with grace, we don't just chip away little parts. We actually get to the heart really, really quick. Grace is what exposes the heart. And grace is what allows us to sprinkle in truth. Grace is what allows us to lean in to people who are far from God and help them understand how much he truly does love them, how much he wants their heart, and what he can do with their heart. But it all begins from a place of grace, because grace is what ultimately exposes a heart. So if you are a Christian, I just want to ask you to use your imagination for a minute. Can you imagine what our world would look like if we just began to do that? Can you imagine, let me sit over here with this guy. Can you imagine if as Christians, we decided that we were going to lean into conversations that were full of grace, full of acceptance, full of love, and allow that to expose people's hearts, that gives us an opportunity to share a little bit of truth. What would our world look like if we as Christians had just gotten this right over the last decade? What would our world look like if we just started getting this right today? I mean, make it even smaller for you. What would your homes look like if we just started doing this, right? What would your home look like if you led with grace and seasoned with salt? What would your relationships with your children look like if you led with grace and seasoned with salt? What would your friendships look like? What would your neighborhood look like? What would our community look like? If we as Christians just decided that salt is important, but salt by itself is kind of gross, and the way that we can expose people to a little bit of truth may be just by loving them through grace first, and that grace would eventually open the door to truth. And listen, if you're an outsider with us today, if you're not a Christian, part of the reason you probably aren't a Christian is because you just can't understand grace. And the reason you can't understand grace is partially because our world doesn't revolve around it, but the other reason you can't is because we as Christians and we as a church have just been such bad representations of grace. We haven't shown you grace. We expect you to behave the way that we do. Why would we expect you to do that? You've never agreed to that, right? I believe wholeheartedly, maybe I'm naive enough to believe this, and you can tell me later if this is stupid, but I'm naive enough to think that if we as Christians would lean into those people who are outsiders, lean into the world from a place of grace, it would change the world. And instead of using politics and all these other mechanisms to try to change the world, we would change people's hearts, and their hearts would change the world. I think that's what Paul was getting at. And I think that's what Jesus always displayed. That if we're going to be wise in the way we act towards outsiders, we have to have conversations that are full of grace and seasoned with salt. Now, next week, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about a little more about these conversations. And I'm actually going to give you an answer to every single question that anybody on the outside may ever ask. I'm going to give you the one answer that answers every question. But before we leave today, I want us to spend a couple of minutes, and And we're going to sing one more song together. And we don't do this every week. But I'm going to have Candy and these guys come out. And we're going to sing a song that we all know. It's a song, Amazing Grace. And as we sing this song, here's what I want you to realize. That grace really is amazing. It's hard to understand, but it's so attractive. And what I hope that you do as Christians as we sing this song is you decide that you're going to embrace grace. And if you're not a Christian, I hope you'll evaluate if maybe you could trust Jesus enough to lean in to his grace. So as the band comes out, I'd love for you guys to pray with me, and then we're going to sing. Father God, thank you so much for your grace. God, thank you that you do not give us what we deserve. Thank you that you do not operate from a place of fairness, but you operate from a place of grace. Thank you that we have the opportunity to lean into that with you. Thank you that we have an opportunity to have a relationship with you, not because of how we behave, not because of what we do or don't do, but just because of what you have done on our behalf, for how much you love us. So God, I pray that we as a church and that we as Christians will begin to change our community and change our world, not through being spreaders of salt and truth. God, I pray that we will first have conversations that are full of grace. And that in doing so, God, we will trust that you will present opportunities to season with salt. And as salt makes sense, we'll season it. And as it doesn't, we'll back away as to not ruin a meal. And I pray that as we expose the heart, that you will do what only you can do in those hearts. So God, please give us wisdom to know what to do with that. And God, most of all, give us courage to actually do it. We love you, and that we pray this in your son's name. Amen. Hey, I'd love for you guys to stand up as we close.